The early readings in the early part of the year, we go through this 52-week cycle, 53-week cycle sometimes, of all these different readings of Swamiji. We've been doing it, some of us now, for 20 years or so since Swamiji wrote these commentaries in the first place. And these first readings are always a little challenging, not only challenging philosophically, which is self-evident, but when, insofar as it is my responsibility, my opportunity to speak about them, they also present an interesting challenge for me personally. And the attitude that I have toward them, I think, is shared by some of you, so I'll speak of it in this way. I've always had an extremely practical attitude toward the spiritual path, and it's an attitude that has been profoundly reinforced by my association with Swami Kriyananda and my life in the Ananda communities. I mentioned that this is the 40th anniversary year of Ananda. It was 1968, 67, 68, when Swamiji bought the first piece of land up near Grass Valley, California, that was the first community for Ananda, which has resulted in the proliferation, small proliferation of these communities, including what we're enjoying here right now. Because from the beginning, the way he expressed these teachings was in the form of community. There was always a need to ground the teaching in everyday life. It was not a monastic retreat, sort of pulled away from the everyday concerns of people. It was not individuals living in caves or in wattle huts out in the desert. It was ordinary Americans, some married, some with children, without much money, without shelter, without much of anything, having to figure out from the ground up how we were going to live a life that was both practical, and that we would be able to eat and take care of ourselves and our children, and prepare them to interact with this world, because we didn't anticipate that merely because a person was born there or dragged there by their parents, that it would be a life that they would want for themselves. It wasn't fair to them not to integrate them into the world around them, nor were we looking to turn our backs on society. So it always had to have some practical application. So long, abstract speculations about the 14th ray and the particular color of the 14th ray and the, you know, bizarre entities or this and that, which many people delight in talking about, just would neither pay the bills nor grow the plants, you know, nor comfort the children. So it always had to be something really solid, even subjects like the chakras. For many, many years, which are about the inner energy inside, I never gave any classes on that because I just couldn't figure out what it had to do with everyday life. Finally, about 15 years into the spiritual path, Swamiji gave a series of classes on the chakras in which he explained how those inner energies relate to the outer qualities that we need to be successfully interact in this world, and it turned it for me. So now we are in this part about John the Baptist was not as fully realized as Jesus, and he was able to testify to the light, but he wasn't the light itself. And then we have this long and charming conversation with Yogananda, one of his disciples, in which the disciple is determined to be able to declare that his guru is God, and Yogananda good-naturedly does his best to show his disciple that how impersonal the spiritual path is. And I try to think, you know, what does that have to do with the rising price of gasoline, you know, and the American election, and, you know, just all the things that I know everybody's thinking about. The last week I was away from home. First, I went to Chicago to give a couple of programs on these teachings, and then I have one remaining relative of my father's generation, and so I went to visit my father's brother in Philadelphia for a while. I mean, I was out of my own nest. And it's very good to go out of one's own nest often, because it gives you an understanding of just where people's lives are flowing. And I did not find that most people were pondering the question of the descent of avatars. It just, like, you know, I didn't see it on CNN. I didn't hear Hillary Clinton raise it. You know, Barack Obama never mentioned it. It just never came up as far as I could see. People are intensely longing for a great deal. but they don't have exact words for it. And they, we, we're all the same. There's just this very deep intuitive understanding that perfect happiness is our divine birthright. And there is a very practiced, highly developed ability among the majority of citizens of Earth to blind ourselves to that fact, or to at least keep it in abeyance, because we don't know what to do about that. We live our lives mostly with intense preoccupation with trivia, just following our little habits, having our little ways of doing things. And you know, it's exaggerated when I spent time with elderly relatives in this whole facility. They live in this beautiful big place where everybody is at least my age or older. And you sort of see how the fruit of the habits of a lifetime, as the possibilities of life narrow, those habits assume a greater and greater proportion of one's consciousness. As the brain doesn't function as well and doesn't function as flexibly, it kind of falls into the default setting. I've often told you all the story of Kamala Silva, who was a great disciple of Master. She wrote The Flawless Mirror. At the end of her life, she went completely senile. Just had senior dementia in a marvelous way. And you wonder why a disciple like that would have that experience. But being with her, you really could hardly call it a curse. On a certain level, you had to call it a blessing. Because the habit of her mind, she became a disciple when she was just a child. Her mother came to Master and she was a young girl, and so she just literally, her whole life, she was devoted to her guru in a very, very heartfelt way. And so the habit of her mind had always been to see life not in terms of its external reality, but deeply in terms of her own inner states of consciousness. And she had Master arranged for her, Master encouraged her to marry and actually found a husband for her, did not encourage her to become a monastic. So she lived in the world and did many different things. She had a deep devotion to animals and had a sort of a long ministry to animals. It was just her way. But in the midst of everything that Kamala did, and I didn't know her until the end of her life, her focus was always inward. So that whatever the activities were that she was engaged in, she was less engaged in those realities for their own sake and deeply engaged in her attunement with Master and her inner sense of behaving as his instrument. And what she became centered on increasingly as the years passed was simply the flow of divine consciousness through her, and less about herself or any aspect of her life except that quality of consciousness. You see, that's all we actually ever have. Whatever we're doing, and life has required of us many different things, there are many choices. The choice we have is what level of reality are we going to be inwardly experiencing, no matter what we're being asked to do on the outside. In Autobiography of a Yogi, there is an extremely important phrase. It says, thoughts are not individual, they are universal. We do not create the states of consciousness we express, we experience, we merely tune into them and become instruments for them. This is like, there's so many sentences in Autobiography. Master's disciple Rajasi, his most advanced disciple, in some of the advice he gave to the monks, he seldom said anything, Swamiji said, except Om Guru, Om Guru. Swamiji said he was one of the most silent people he ever met. He just didn't speak. Sometimes literally when you would ask him something, he would just say, Om Guru, Om Guru. But one of the little bits of advice he gave was to study Autobiography of a Yogi. He said, don't read it, study it. And there's phrases in there like, thoughts are universal. Now, we live inside our thoughts all the time, don't we? And we can't help but think, if we're very physically oriented, we tend to identify with our bodies, but by the time you're coming to sit in here, we've probably mostly elevated ourselves to thinking of ourselves as our thoughts, at least. And we tend to think that what I'm thinking, as Master put it so charmingly, concerns me personally. that it really has something to do with me. But Master makes that statement that it's just levels of consciousness that are out there for us to choose from. When I try to explain this to people, as I had the opportunity to do when I was in Chicago, to explain these ideas to people who'd never ever heard of them before, which is always so much fun. I just love the blank slate, because anything you say is treated with such appreciation. But the image that has always been so vivid to me, it's right here, right now. If we had a radio and turned on the radio, or a television set, but let's just use a radio, and turned it on, we would discover that we have access in this very moment to all sorts of things that we mostly don't want, but nonetheless that we could have if we wanted to. We just take that radio dial, we put it in a certain place, and we discover that right in this room, invisible to us, are all these waves of radio, as it were. I don't know what a radio actually is, but whatever it is, the radio waves are there. We could capture them, and then with the proper instrument, we could project them. And then we could shift the dial, and we could hear somebody else doing something else. I think even at this moment, Garrison Keillor is probably telling very good stories. You might want that one. You could put that all in, and you could just do that. And then you could shut it off, and it would cease to exist. It wouldn't go away. We would just cease to have an instrument to express it. Master loved these images of radio and television and movies, and the way the single beam of the movie creates the whole reality, and we become so engaged in it, we forget that it's just a single beam of light. We think that it's all really happening. He often talked about radio and television and airplanes and all of these things, because as we get into these higher ages, it explains these subtle realities. I'm very grateful to movies, because they've shown us how the body falls away and the soul keeps going, the self keeps going. We have all these pictures in our minds of after-death movies where the body gets up, but it just walks through the walls and so on. Well, right now, and at any moment, there is this divine reality equally existent, absolutely in this moment. There's nothing, there's no time, space, distance between us and the most elevated consciousness possible to a living being, infinity itself. It's entirely a question of what we're choosing to tune into. And we are entirely defined by what we choose to tune into. It's as simple as that. Kamala, in her life, for decades, from a young age, her mind was always tuned to the presence of the Guru within her, and the presence of God through the Guru. And all the things that she did, that's what she was really training her mind to do, was to constantly tune into that. So when her brain, because of age, began to sort of crack and melt and not fire in the same way, so that her senses didn't work, and the articulation didn't work, and the memory didn't work, none of that made the slightest difference, because the brain is just a very small part of our consciousness. Is not even the most important part, except for us who are so brain-oriented. But all of her training had been toward that inner vibration. And so even when she couldn't say or speak or do anything, when she met David and me, she said, "Tell me your names. I will immediately forget them, but tell me anyway." Just like that, you know. And then we told her, and we could see that she immediately forgot it. But the whole habit of her consciousness was toward the bliss of her attunement with God. And even when she was totally non-functional in this world anymore, that bliss never left her. Because the only question she'd ever asked is, how can I have more of that? And then, yes, let me carry on the duties that God has given me, because he's given them to me. And on the spiritual path, that's what it all comes down to. It comes down to, what are we attuning our consciousness to? What radio station are we listening to? Who am I being an instrument for? What am I being an instrument for? That's the beginning, the middle, and the end of the spiritual path. We entertain ourselves with all these very fascinating concepts, and I'm fascinated by them, and I love to explain them to people, and I love to answer people's questions. But when it's all over, it's just a question that thoughts are universally rooted and not individual. And now, what our reading today is about, and what a lot of this is about, is the simple fact that walking among us through the ages, right now, in the past, in the future, we have individually incarnated human beings who have completely mastered the art of tuning into the right station. That's what Yogananda is trying to say. He's saying that, yes, you see this wave. You see the wave, which is my individual soul, my jiva, as they call it, the individual self living in this body. But this body, all the mechanism of this body is tuned to the ocean. And you can watch the wave. And this is where Master tried to explain it to this disciple. He tried to say to him, yes, but if the wave is so purely identified with the ocean, how can you speak of the wave so emphatically? And the wave itself can't even speak of itself that way. The wave can't call itself anything but the ocean. It can't just single out its little wave and say, lo, this mighty wave. That's where Yogananda says at the end, those who say they are God, he who says he is God isn't. You know, because if any individual being grasps that, then to that extent he's listening to the wrong station. But then, of course, he who says he isn't, isn't. And it just, Master was just playing with words at that point. But for all of us, this simple fact of the potential as demonstrated, as lived by these great souls, Jesus or whomever, and as the Bhagavad Gita said, they come again and again whenever we have need of them. Ask yourself, when do we not have need of them? When is the moment? And not until we ourselves have realized that within ourselves. What do we wish to attune ourselves to? How do we wish to age? Who do we want to become when everything is gradually stripped away from us? When we no longer have the capacity endlessly to distract ourselves? I looked at the face of my aunt who's in her late 80s and, you know, she's still very beautiful, but she doesn't look beautiful like young people look beautiful. You know, the face is all withered up. I love seeing it. I just sort of look at her little face, you know, with her, she has these lovely little blue eyes and all these wrinkles like this, you know, just none of this youthful beauty anymore. But it's like that's the fruit of a lifetime. Where do we want to be at that point? Where do you want to be tomorrow? Everything that we are in this moment is nothing but the accumulated habit of everything we've done until this moment. Are we perfectly happy? You know, is this the apex we can imagine for ourselves? It feels sometimes so overwhelming. How do I become something different? Master had such simple advice. Take care of the minutes, he said. Take care of the minutes, and the incarnations will take care of themselves. We have one responsibility that actually matters, which is to be vigilant about our consciousness. Every time we begin to think negative thoughts toward other people, every time we begin to think self-justifying thoughts, every time we complain, I mean, it's not possible for most of us to live at a very elevated level of consciousness at all times. You know, we get tired, we want distractions, we want novels, we want television, there's many different things. We want ice cream. You know, it's not possible, nor is it even asked of us by our teachings, that we always live in this state of detached purity. But we can always live in a state of loving kindness, you see. So don't think that the compromise of being human beings and still having karma to work out in all these ways excuses meannesses of the heart. When Swamiji asked Master some question, I can't recall what the question even was now, but Master's answer was very simple. God reads the heart. So even no matter what activities we're engaged in, it's not our passion for ice cream or for good movies that binds us to unhappiness so much as it's the little meannesses of the heart. It's the little small-minded preoccupations and fears. Those are the minute minutes we need to take care of. At all times, whatever we're doing, watch the heart, because that's what God is watching. Find ways to be kind. I remember that I tell this story in the book I wrote about Swamiji at the very beginning of our work in India. it was a great deal of pressure on people. Now they're 4 or 5 years into it, and it's beginning to get a flow, but people were under a lot of pressure. And there was a couple of instances where one person, there was a few angry exchanges. You know, somebody took it upon themselves to tell someone else all the things that were wrong with him, and back and forth like this. Swami called an emergency meeting of the entire staff. He called them all together, and he said very simply this. First, he was perfectly fair. He spoke of the one. He said, perhaps so-and-so needed his faults pointed out to him, but it would have been better if it had been done with less anger. That's how he put it. Just cut the baby right in half and left it there. And then he said, if you follow nothing else that I ask of you, be kind to one another. And that was it. Then he sent everybody home. That was the entire meeting. And it's very interesting to reflect on that. If you follow nothing else that I ask of you, be kind to one another. Because you see, the capacity to be kind to one another, it covers everything, doesn't it? Because we're no longer thinking about ourselves and what we want. We're no longer thinking that we're the only creature on the planet. We have sympathetic concern for others. Somebody once apparently asked the Dalai Lama, what was his advice for raising children? He said, teach them to be kind to those creatures that are weaker than they are. Teach them to be kind to small animals. Isn't that interesting? But you see, that's the beginning of everything. If we recognize our own, humbly recognize our own desperate need for kindness, and then expansively recognize the same need in everyone around us, everything else will follow from that. And I don't just mean kindness of deed. I mean kindness of thought, and even a step backwards, kindness of perception. You know, you can't fool God. You can't just talk nice and think mean. It doesn't work. Because when everything begins to function less well, who you really are will show. This is the great joy of the spiritual path. It's as simple as that. The spiritual path is the practice of joy, and the more we practice it, the more joyful we become. Even a little practice of this inward religion, the Bhagavad Gita promised, will save us from dire fears and colossal suffering. Isn't that a wonderful promise? Bless you.